copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Okay, let's move on now to our second theme. We'll have a break after this session here, too. This one, now we're going to turn to talk about my upbringing made me do it. We already looked at biological determinism. Now we're going to look at environmental determinism. And as I suggested, secular thinkers typically have two main options, biological determinism or environmental determinism. Actually, there is another option of existentialism, such. We're not going to get into that quite yet. We'll get into that later. But in the mid-20th century, behaviorist psychologists dominated the field of psychology, and behaviorist psychologists taught that humans were simply stimulus-response machines. And in a 1989 biography of one of the leading figures in the movement toward behaviorist psychology, whose name was John B. Watson, his biography is entitled Mechanical Man. Because again, he saw humans as being basically machines, and they're just stimulus response. They receive some inputs from the environment, and then they put that, you know, they just respond or behave in ways based on those inputs that are coming in. So they're not biological determinists because they see the human as being a little more, the human biology as being more passive in some sense, and they see the environmental inputs as being what's really driving the behavior. So education, upbringing, training, these kinds of things are what's going to be impacting, according to them, the human being. So John B. Watson admitted that his psychology was strictly deterministic, and here's what he said. Interestingly, about this ability, or rather about the tendencies toward training to influence behavior. He said, "Give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take anyone at random and train him to become any type of specialist I can select. A doctor, a lawyer, artist, merchant chief, and yes, even a beggar man and a thief. Regardless of his talents, penchants, tendencies, abilities, vocations, and the race of his ancestors." Okay, so radical equality here among humans. We all have basically the same biological tendencies, according to Watson here. And if we just get the right environmental stimuli, you know, we can train them to be whatever we want them to be. Interestingly, once again, as Christians, we sometimes can look at the, try to focus on how their philosophy works out in reality or works out in practice. And in John B. Watson's case, it didn't work particularly well. In his own child raising, he ended up with one son who became a psychiatrist. And Watson considered that a slap in the face because his whole approach was using environmental influences and such on people. And psychiatry, the kind of psychiatry his son was doing, was more looking at biological and other kinds of influences and such. So Watson considered that a rejection of his ideas. And another one of his sons committed suicide. So Watson didn't fare particularly well personally in his practice. In fact, he didn't fare very well personally in his own career either, because he ended up torpedoing his own career through sexual infelicities with students during his time, too. So he actually had problems with his own behavior that he couldn't bring under control in certain ways. But in any case, it's interesting that when you examine the idea of, this is just one major example of environmental determinism, that is still pretty prominent in a lot of the social sciences in the United States and Europe. But if we look at this idea about environmental determinism and the contest of nature versus nurture, there's a lot of people who look at the biological determinism. They see things like the Nazi regime and compulsory sterilization and all these other things. And so there's a lot of people who react against those ideas of biological determinism. And they think somehow that environmental determinism is sort of kinder and gentler and nicer, you know, using environmental education and things like that. And in some ways it can be, I suppose. I mean, the nature side and the biological determinism determinism is promoting racism and other kinds of things, and so we want to disassociate from that. However, I would argue that reducing humans to their environmental impulses, environmental inputs, also ends up devaluing human life and also makes into humans something that is not really true to reality, and specifically because it denies any kind of free agency to humans or personality to humans. And in fact, if we look at, if we associate biological determinism with Nazism, environmental determinism was a major feature of the communist worldview. And so the body count of communists in the 20th century was actually far more than the Nazis. The best counts we have right now are about 100 million people died under communist regimes over the course of the 20th century. So environmental determinism also has a, sort of a dark side to it that in the devaluing of human life. So let me take a step back now and sort of look at the historical development of this and how we got to where we're at in this regard. Environmental determinism first became popular in the Enlightenment period among intellectuals who were embracing materialist philosophy. And again, some like Julian de la Mettrie embraced biological determinism, but there were other ones like Helvetius, another prominent French thinker, materialist, who embraced environmental determinism and thought that it's basically about education and upbringing and environment and such, and that's what shapes humans. And so this became a prominent force in the 19th century and was going to undergird a lot of 19th century liberalism. People such as John Stuart Mill in Britain, who is probably the most famous British philosopher of the 19th century, had tremendous faith in education because they thought that it could shape and change human nature and who we are as humans. And in fact, socialists in the 19th century were even more enthusiastic about environmental determinism and using the environment to try to shape humans. In the early 19th century, the most famous British socialist was Robert Owen. And Robert Owen continually spoke against the idea of free will and argued that humans do not have free will and they're shaped completely by their background, their education, their environment, their upbringing. In his one of his more prominent books called The Book of the New Moral World, he stated that man is, quote, not responsible for his will and his actions. It will be known, he continued, that man is altogether a being whose organization, feelings, thoughts, will, and actions are predetermined for him by the influence of external circumstances acting upon his original constitution, and that he is, therefore, irresponsible for the character formed for him, whatever it may be. Interestingly, I don't know what you'd have to say about his own moral upbringing and such, but obviously he's making some statements about his own self that I think are kind of interesting. In any case, Robert Owen actually did try to create a socialist community. In fact, there were a number of European socialists in the early 19th century who tried to set up colonies, especially in the United States, because the United States had a lot of cheap land and such. And so Owen tried to set up a colony in Indiana in the United States. And it was a disaster. It was called New Harmony, but unfortunately they didn't have enough harmony in New Harmony. It ended up collapsing on him. And that didn't make Robert Owen give up his philosophical ideas. He just basically said that he didn't have good enough human material to work with, that their upbringing had not been sufficient to prepare them for, you know, this new kind of socialist experiment there. And so he was hoping that he could find patrons in Britain. In fact, he was continually trying to find people in Britain who would help him to implement his program and such. And he was hoping that he could sort of become the guru who would, you know, lead into a more utopian realm that he thought he could bring in by shaping education and the environment and such. One of the most famous of the 19th century socialists, of course, was Karl Marx. And Karl Marx also was preaching a particular brand of environmental determinism. And Marx's brand of environmental determinism is sometimes referred to as economic determinism, because he believed that the particular element of the environment that had the most impact on humans was the economy. And so he thought that ultimately everything about the evolution of human society came down to what the economic system was. And so that he thought that if you can change the economic system, you can change humanity. And so his belief was that when he was talking about trying to overthrow capitalism and, you know, introduce a more egalitarian, classless society, and the basis of which was the elimination of private property, he thought that by eliminating private property, you can actually transform the human being and totally change them in such a way that you could then usher in a harmonious communist society. And he thought that then this would bring about tremendous freedom. Now, interestingly, we don't really associate communism today with freedom because, again, I would argue that his impoverished world, his impoverished view of humanity led him to a experiment in social engineering, trying to engineer humans in ways that were ultimately devaluing of us as humans. Communist regimes have gone on to become some of the most oppressive regimes in history, and I argue that it's because of their false view of humanity. It's because they thought that they could just reshape humanity by changing the economic system. And if people didn't conform to, you know, if people, once they changed the economic system, didn't conform, then they would try to re-educate them, you know, in one way or another, through concentration camps, labor camps, and such. Or sometimes even occasionally during the Soviet Union, they would put them in insane asylums to try to reprogram them, you know, get them on board with the communist agenda. I think one of the more brilliant people who's pointed out the problems here of communism in this respect is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who himself endured the gulag under the Soviet regime. Solzhenitsyn exposed the folly of the communist policies in his writings, in his famous book, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, for example. He has his main character, Ivan Denisovich Shukov, who is working at one point, and at one point in the novel says, they could not change my character. And, you know, that's a very telling statement because, of course, the whole point of him being in that camp was they were trying to change his character. And then if you look at what's going on in the camp all around, you see guys you know, basically trying to be entrepreneurs and in the camp themselves in whatever ways they could. You see all these different things that are being very non-communistic in all sorts of ways in the camp. There's all sorts of corruption. There's all sorts of other things in it that are not associated with the way that the communists are supposed to be creating their humans into the new way that they're trying to make them. In the mid-20th century, environmental determinism thrived, and even in the early 21st century as well, it still has a good bit of influence. In the early 20th century, it was going to be shaped by the behaviorist psychology, which I mentioned already at the start of my talk. And one of the more prominent behavior psychologists in the mid-20th century was named B.F. Skinner, a follower of Watson's. He wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Beyond Freedom and Dignity. His argument there is that humans do not have freedom. Humans are determined by their all these inputs coming in from them. And also notice, beyond dignity, he's also arguing there's no human dignity either there. And a very interesting frame. By the way, Francis Schaeffer wrote a response to Skinner's work. And Schaeffer's work is called Back to Freedom and Dignity, in which he takes issue with Skinner's environmental determinism. Skinner also published a novel called Walden 2, where he tries to set out a utopian society and show what a utopian society would be like, you know, that tried to use the principles that he was embracing. But ultimately, what he sets out is a technocracy, that is, a rule by educated elites who are trying to basically engineer humanity, and he even uses the term behavioral engineering there, so for his technocracy there. So Skinner was promoting environmental determinism. In the field of anthropology throughout the 20th century and on until today as well, cultural relativism was going to come to dominate the field of anthropology, which was based on a notion of environmental determinism. All the people in these different cultures have different views, and that's just what they've come to be because of the education and upbringing that they've had. And indeed, today, environmental determinism is still a pretty strong force in the social sciences. So let me turn now to critiquing this and start thinking about this view of environmental determinism and how we can respond to it. Well, first of all, there's something that's very interesting, I think, about environmental determinism in that, in a sense, there's a way that it's self-refuting. And what I mean by that is that if they believe that their ideas are determined, and many of them do, many of them think that not just behaviors of different sort, but even your thoughts, your impressions, those are all determined by your education and your upbringing. Well, if my thoughts are all determined by my education and upbringing, then they don't have any claim to truth. So any of your claims would have just as much claim to truth as my claims, which are all just the product of our upbringing and education. So no one can stand up and say, wait a minute, I have the real truth. No, you're just the product of your environment and upbringing just like everyone else. So there's a sense in which it refutes itself, and C.S. Lewis has pointed this out too in some of his writings, and in That Hideous Strength, his novel about a futuristic society in his science fiction trilogy. He sort of points this out too, that the people that are trying to engineer humanity, where did they get their ideas from? Where are they coming from? Well, they've been engineered themselves, and so how can they then stand above the fray? But interestingly, people like B.F. Skinner and others who are wanting to set up these technocratic societies, they are, in a sense, making the claim that somehow this technocratic elite does have some way of getting out of, you know, their own programming, and they're now going to be able to program everyone else. So there's a basic tension I see in that thing. Also, they tend to propose, many of these thinkers tend to propose environmental changes that they think can improve humanity. So certainly Skinner and his Walden II, Karl Marx, you know, thinking about his communist society and such. But their worldview doesn't really give them any warrant, at least as far as I can tell, for the idea of progress. That is, if you buy into materialism, there's nothing to judge what is morally better than what we have now. So you're saying we're going to bring about progress by, you know, changing the educational system. Well, wait a minute. What are you progressing toward? Progress implies you're going toward some goal. What is the goal? They don't have any goal. They don't have any fixed goal that they can point toward. And so it seems to me their worldview ends up without an idea of progress, which they are still wanting to promote in their philosophies. Also, again, they end up promoting programs that manipulate other people based on their own perspective. So they're trying to promote their own ideas and then manipulate everyone else to conform to their own desires. And I'd argue that's one of the reasons why it becomes so devaluing of human life, because they see everyone else as being the mechanism that they're working on. But of course, they don't see themselves as being just mechanical. I mean, philosophically, they would say they are. But the way they act, they somehow think they can put themselves above that. And then finally, I would say one of the biggest issues, and I've already mentioned this in the course of the talk, is that it denies moral agency. It denies that humans have any kind of free will to make choices and to have personal responsibility and personal agency for our things. And we as Christians need to understand that we do have moral agency. We are person. We have personality. We're not just cogs in a machine we're not just having to just receive these inputs from outside and just spit them out just like we've received them. You know, that there's a sense in which we are persons and we can react. We take these environmental inputs and we have to choose what we're going to do with them. And so those are the reasons why I would think that environmental determinism does ultimately end up with devaluing human life, and that we have a better message of the sanctity of human life. Okay.